This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser. Every day we're bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance, plus technology, politics, so much going on in the world of politics, economics, and it's all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors. You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio. And be sure to watch us too on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
There's so much going on when it comes to a vaccine. Keep in mind, global coronavirus cases passing 73 million, deaths surpassing 1.62 million. For more on what he is seeing is Dr. Stephen Corin. He's president and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital, who the New York Times called in the spring the CEO at the center of New York's coronavirus crisis. I should point out the first confirmed case in the New York area was in one of New York Presbyterian's hospitals in southern Westchester. Dr. Corin joining us on the phone in New York City. Dr. Corin, thank you. So nice to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you and what are you seeing when it comes to COVID cases right now?
Well, thanks, Carol and Tim, for having me on. We're seeing a significant increase in COVID cases. We're at about 25% of what our peak was in the April time frame, and we expect it quickly to go to the 30-35% range by Christmas time, if not a little bit after. So we're seeing a significant uptick. The good news is that people are less sick with the virus as we see it. During April, we had a mortality rate in the hospital of about 20%. Extraordinary. Now it's down to about 5%, which is still horrific, especially if it's your loved one, but much less than April. So I would say we've got a rough 4 to 6 weeks ahead of us, I think that we'll get through it, especially as we start vaccinating people.
Quick follow-up. Do you anticipate that we're going to get back to those levels in terms of hospitalizations and cases? Well, we are there, but in terms of hospitalizations that we saw back in the spring?
We hope not. We're clearly mindful of that. Our modeling would show that we would peak in the middle of January, unless we have a really terrible Christmas season in terms of people traveling and avoiding social distancing and masking. We still haven't seen the full peak of what happened in Thanksgiving. So
wow.
That really is a variable that relates to this directly. So certainly no one wants to go back to where the city was in April, and we certainly don't.
Right.
Again, until we get mass vaccination, masking, social distancing, washing your hands, all the things you keep hearing about become really critical. And I empathize with our elected officials in terms of how much of a lockdown do you need to have versus not. I think a lot of it depends on how much virus is circulating.
Dr. Corwin, why has the mortality rate gone down so much? Is it because of what we've learned, what you've learned since March, since April? Is it because the hospital is not strained in the same way? Is it because of therapeutics?
I think first, the answer to your question is I really don't know, to be honest with you. I do think that we certainly know how to take care of the patients better. Remdesivir, steroids, they may not be game changers, but we know how to use these drugs. With the masking and social distancing, are people getting less of a viral load when they get sick? We've certainly seen a shift to a younger demographic who tends to be less sick with the virus. And to your point, any system that gets overwhelmed, it becomes more difficult to save lives. So the ability to not get the hospital overwhelmed, I think, plays into it as well. So all of the above, but it's going to take us a while to sort through this. Becoming less virulent, we don't see that, but that's going to take time for us to figure out.
One thing that you just said really struck me. People wearing masks, that you get less of a viral load. I haven't heard that before. What does that mean?
Well, remember, masks aren't totally effective, but it helps to filter out particles. And so we use the N95 masks when we're caring for patients. And that clearly prevents inhalation of the virus particles. So wearing a surgical mask not only protects the person that you would be breathing on, but also helps to protect you. And if you get less of a viral load, you may have a milder infection than if somebody gave you a full viral load, which is clearly what we saw in the beginning of the pandemic.
Right. It's so simple, but it does make a difference. Hey, what do you make, Dr. Corwin, a new mutation of COVID-19 turned up in, I guess, more than 1,000 infected patients in the UK and was being blamed for more rapid spread of the contagion. Does that make you a little nervous?
It does. I mean, I think that this, we know that the virus has many, many mutations. I mean, this is not the first one. When people went on holiday this summer, they came back with a variation from Spain, which appeared to be more virulent and caused wider spread. So this is not surprising. Viruses, like anything else, mutate over time. The fortunate aspect for us vis-a-vis the vaccine is the spike protein is the key in terms of inducing immunogenicity. And so knowing the spike protein and developing the mRNA towards the spike protein, I think we're in pretty good shape regardless of the variations now in terms of making sure that that the vaccination will be very effective.
Right, because that's what I've heard, that the current vaccines still will work on these mutations. Is that correct?
That's correct. As far as I know, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And I think that because the spike protein has not changed.
Right.
So it's not as the mutation profile is not what we see in influenza. And I think that that's encouraging. And we're very bullish on the mRNA platform and the vaccine, both the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine.
So, Dr. Corwin, I want to ask you, when you were interviewing the Times back in May, you noted that our assumptions around pandemic preparations were flawed. Are there assumptions we are making right now about this wave of the COVID breakout, this other wave, another wave, and about the distribution of the vaccine and the impact that will have? Might some of those assumptions be flawed as well?
Well, anytime you're doing probabilistic analysis, there can always be flaws in the model. What I would say, though, is we grossly underestimated pre-pandemic the amount of protective equipment we would need for personnel protective equipment. We have over 90 days of supply for every major category of that. We had issues in terms of, do we have enough ventilators? We clearly don't have that issue now. We know how to create extra ICU beds, and we know how to create staffing models that protect our patients. So from that standpoint, we're much better off. Where I think that we can make a mistake as a country is to assume that the vaccine's here, we can let down our guard, and let's go back to business as usual. It's going to take a while for us to get to herd immunity, and so we've got to do two things simultaneously. Be really stringent about the guidelines and separating ourselves from each other, as tough as that may be, and let people get vaccinated and educate the population on the vaccine. We have a lot of the population is skeptical of the vaccine. Our populations of color who've been experimented upon in the past are skeptical of the vaccine. So we've really got to educate the population as to the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. And then hopefully by the spring, we'll be at a point where we can really start to get out of this.
Dr. Corwin, I want to know about the hospital's finances and the financial health of the hospitals that you oversee. I know they took a big hit earlier this year with elective surgeries canceled and being put off, but how do they stand today?
Well, we're fortunate. Our balance sheet, we're AA rated. We have a very strong balance sheet. But on a base of $9 billion, we typically would have a margin of between 3 and 4%. We're going to lose close to $800 million this year.
Wow.
We had to put about $300 million into our employees, child care, bus service, meals, bonuses, and we're proud that we were able to do that. I think we'll get better next year, but a lot of it depends upon the economy coming back to normal and people being able to move about freely.
Well, and when do you think we will be moving about around freely? Is it next summer? Is it next fall?
I hope by next summer we really see that. I hope that by May we've got mass vaccination. I think a lot of it depends, quite frankly, on the distribution mechanism of the vaccine. some of the storage issues with the vaccine. I think the incoming administration will be laser focused on making sure that we get the vaccine into arms. And I think that's really critical. The Pfizer vaccine, we're very happy to give because as an institution, we have plenty of freezer storage for minus 80 degrees. That's much more challenging if you're trying to give vaccine in the community. The Moderna vaccine is easier to store, and some of the later vaccines will be easier to store. But I think that's going to be a challenge for us logistically.
Hey, just got about a minute left. When does the mass public, like, what's the rollout look for the rest of us eventually when that comes? Is it that you're going to get a call from your doctor, or they're going to call up people based on age? Like, how are they going to do it? What do we know about that, if anything, at this point? Just quickly.
I think you have to assume that what's going to happen is once we do the healthcare workers and the nursing home residents, you'll have a balancing act between essential workers and then people over the age of 70, maybe over the age of 65, and people with significant comorbid conditions. If you're a healthy 35-year-old, you're going to be towards the end of that line, if you will. So I think you're going to be talking about age, comorbidities, and essential workers. And we know that our essential workers are at risk, whether you're working in the subway, a grocery store, whether you're a longshoreman, whether you're a truck driver. So I think that's really critical for us to get the economy going better.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Corwin, thank you so much. I know things are crazy and you're busy, so that you carved out so much time for us. Thank you so much. Be well and stay safe for you and your team and your families. Dr. Stephen Corwin, he's president and CEO of New York Presbyterian, joining us on the phone in New York City.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
We love Sean Donnan, yes, for his reporting, and especially when he can weave in the 1968 zombie classic Night of the Living Dead to tell a really weighty story about the American economy facing a zombie recovery. I know you caught up with him over on Quick Take earlier today.
We did earlier, and Carol, we're going to get to Sean and Joel in just a sec, but I mean, this story, it puts a name and a story to the people.
Yep.
Who have been affected by the pandemic and by the lack of movement in Washington, which is something we talk about all the time, but we don't meet the people who've been affected.
Right. Really like drilling down. And that's what Sean is so good at. Let's bring in Sean. He's Bloomberg News Senior Trade and Globalization Reporter reporting for Bloomberg Business Week. He is with us on the phone in Maryland, along with Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber on the Access Line in Brooklyn. And Joel, it's just a reminder, we talk about these big macro stories, but it's people, it's companies, it's small businesses behind it all.
Yeah, and Sean's been like singularly focused and obsessed with Pennsylvania for several months, and for good reason with the election. And so when he said, "Hey, I want to go to Evans City, Pennsylvania," I was like, "What in the hell is in Evans City, Pennsylvania?" And it turns out it was where the Night of the Living Dead was filmed in 1968. Obviously, a great zombie film. And he goes, "But wait, it's really the most perfect character that you could have for the story of America's zombie economy." So what'd you find there? And I hope you don't say zombies, Sean.
Well, I didn't find any zombies. It's actually, it turns out, been a bad year for zombies, like a lot of us. The Living Dead Museum and Gift Shop in Evans City, which was there to take advantage of tourists who come from around the world to visit this place, which kind of gave birth to the American zombie genre, has shut down. And it's shut down because of the pandemic. And so it is no longer. It's not been a good year for zombies. I think, you know, this story as I was thinking about this story, I was really thinking about not so much the people who've felt the most extreme impact of the economic side of the pandemic, those who've lost their job, those who have joined the bread lines, those who have really, or lost loved ones. I was thinking of that bigger mass of people for whom this has been a hit. They're not dead, but they're not living the same lives that they were beforehand. And that's really what you find in Butler County, which is home to Evans City. It's a suburban county of Pittsburgh. It at the aggregate level looks like a place that is doing better than the rest of America. When it comes to unemployment, certainly. The unemployment rate there in October was 5.9%, which is a full percentage point better than the national rate was in October. And yet you scratch the surface and you discover all of these people who are surviving in a world of kind of curtailed ambitions. The guy who ran the Living Dead Museum and Gift Shop in Evans City started the year thinking he was going to be expanding his business. Instead, he's shutting down that location in Evans City. You go down the street and you talk to people who run one of the local sports bars there. Business is down 60%. You wander shortly out of, you know, short distance out of town, and you run into a company called FiberCon, which makes these little bits of steel that give the kind of reinforced concrete. If you're building a factory floor, you're going to be using those little bits of steel. Their business is down by a third. And you find that same story over and over again in Butler County and in a lot of places in America right now. And that's the kind of that grind, that economic grind that we're stuck in right now.
Yeah, I want to stay on that theme because one of the companies that you spoke to was Ed Beans Incorporated. This is a coffee roaster in Cranberry Township, and they own a regional chain of coffee shops called Crazy Mocha. They did get more than $500,000 in a PPP loan back in April, but it wasn't enough, right?
Yeah, and you know, and that's one of the themes that I think is kind of front of mind right now here in Washington is as Congress is debating a new rescue package for that will include hopefully help for small businesses, is that money that went out in the spring kind of helped a lot of small businesses get through a few months. And if you think back to March and April and May, at that time we thought this thing was going to be with us for maybe 3 or 4 months. And really the priority was on getting companies through that. Well, you know, Crazy Mocha got into the fall and discovered that business had not bounced back. Those office workers had not returned to work. It relies on them to buy coffee, and in October, it filed for bankruptcy and has stopped paying rent. It's got it's 7 of its 23 locations are still open and kind of crawling along. But that's probably something that we should be thinking about more as a leading indicator, really. And a lot of economists worry that while we haven't seen a big surge in bankruptcies this year, we could see it next year unless we get the economy back on track. Because right now the economy is really reliant on this kind of injection of fiscal health, stimulus
right.
That's come from Congress, and it needs more of it to get back to normal life.
Speaking of normal life, what do people like Kevin Kreese, who's the owner of the Living Dead Museum, what are his plans now? And does he hope that he's going to be able to reopen? What's that look like for people who have had to shutter and are trying to figure out the future?
Yeah, so a big part of Kevin Kreese's life was travel. He made his money as the zombie guy at a lot of fan fests around the country and industry conventions, selling zombie T-shirts and other bits of memorabilia. He also staged an annual festival every year, which relied on people coming in. You talk to him, he's got some other businesses selling other kinds of memorabilia online. He'll survive, but the zombie business, he really needs people to be back and traveling again and be comfortable traveling again and hanging out in crowds, because that's how he makes his business.
I mean, bottom line, Sean, I mean, as we look at and these small businesses that you talk to, and as you write in your story, and you mentioned earlier, you know, even, you know, the well-known companies of corporate America, the big publicly held companies, I mean, they've been taking on a lot of debt. And there might be some tricky spots in terms of servicing that debt. So there are a lot of questions about what 2021 might look like. And we've just got about 35 seconds here.
Yeah, and the simple answer to that is you need demand to come back in the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we in the last half of this year, we bought into this narrative, and financial markets certainly bought into this narrative that we were bouncing back, that the recovery was going gangbusters. Well, we've seen that slow down as cases have surged in the last couple of months, and the U.S. economy is going to, and this is really something that stops me every time I think about it, is going to end this year 5% smaller. It's more than $1 trillion smaller than it would have been otherwise if we had not had a pandemic.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. All right, thank you guys so much. That was Bloomberg News Senior Trade and Globalization Reporter Sean Donnan reporting for Bloomberg Business Week, along with Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Tim, I want to do one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg today. It's about how all across Wall Street, the reality is kind of sinking in. Even though we're seeing progress in terms of a vaccine, those folks are going to be working from home for some time.
Big question is,
what?
Is that home in New York or is it in Florida?
Yeah, there is that question because we know all of those things are at play. Hey, let's bring in this story. It was written by Bloomberg's Jenny Serain and Michelle Davis. Joining us right now is Jenny. She's finance reporter at Bloomberg News. She's on the phone in New York City. So, Jenny, tell us about the reporting you and Michelle have been doing, who you're talking to and what you're finding out.
So it seems like, you know, after most of the summer, we heard from lots of the world's biggest banks that they were really looking to bring back a lot of their employees to their New York and U.S. offices more broadly. They really had to taper back. So they've already started to see employees kind of thin out. Some have actually told employees, you know, if it's not absolutely essential for you to be here, we want you to stay home. And for some, it's just the employees themselves saying, you know what, I've got holiday plans. I want to stay put.
What changed? Is it the fact that this wave is so much worse than, well, I won't say that everyone thought, because a lot of people thought it was going to be this bad.
Right.
But, you know, these banks, as you said, were optimistic about getting people butts in seats, as they say, right?
Yeah, I think one of the things that changed is really, you know, as the vaccine has actually made its way here and we're starting to see the initial stages of rollout, I think banks have really come to terms with the fact that their employees are not first in line. You know, it's really healthcare workers and residents in these long-term care facilities that are going to be getting it, at least in this initial round. And so I think as they've come to accept that and just kind of seen how bad this wave really was, it's kind of led executives to maybe pump the brakes a little bit in terms of the messaging around coming back to the office.
Jenny, how many had really come back, though? Because the city has felt pretty quiet. So I'm just curious how many at the big Wall Street banks really had come back to the office?
So the rough numbers that we're hearing is that most places didn't see more than a quarter of people return. So okay. Even though there was lots of messaging and lots of pushing maybe from managers, that 25% number kept coming up in a lot of our conversations. And I think, you know, a lot of that was also for the employees. If they did come back, a lot of them maybe didn't see a real value just because the offices were so empty. So they were doing Zoom calls all day anyways. So it's definitely kind of that vicious cycle after a little bit where if not enough people are back, then more people don't really want to come in.
Yeah.
How flexible are these banks as to where people are actually working? I mean, I was joking with Carol, is this happening in Florida or is it happening in, you know, in Westchester where these employees live?
Right.
Are they allowing them to actually travel to places where they don't live, or are there some sort of, you know, encouragement to be close to the office?
We haven't heard as much of that for New York. Definitely, you know, in Europe, if employees were in different countries, then they were being asked to come back. But we haven't heard as much of that pressure here in New York. But I mean, I do think, especially for younger employees, they were told, you know, you need to start coming back. We want you to be in the city so that you're able to come in as soon as we're able to have you. So I think, you know, I think there was maybe not as much pressure as we saw in other regions, but still definitely that pressure did exist for a little bit of time at least.
Traders are back?
That was definitely who was in the first round of folks.
And they've stayed, I'm assuming, right?
Well, I think the banks have really learned that they can operate a trading floor with only a handful of people in the office. So I think that's what we're going back to now.
What are the long-term implications of a finding like that? I mean, does that mean headcount gets lowered?
No, I actually think the long-term implication is just flexibility. Like, I think it used to be that if a trader, you know, had a plumber coming, they had to take the day and had to be off. And I think they'll be able to just work from home on those days.
I mean, we're talking about places where people still wear suits and ties, right? Like, flexibility is not really in their, you know, vocabulary, right?
Right. So I think that will be the change for a lot of these folks. Is I think in the end, a lot of them will still go back to the office 5 days a week, especially on the trading floor. But
right.
I just think there will be the option that they can work from home more often, at least from the conversations we're having so far.
How much, Jenny, is JP Morgan watching, Citigroup watching, Bank of America watching, Wells or whatever? Like, how much are they all kind of watching one another to figure out what they are doing?
I think, so there's definitely, you know, different forums where executives from these banks come together and talk about this stuff. But I honestly think a lot of it, you see it in the different messaging that you're getting from these banks. You know, Citi was an example where they were really cautious and they mm-hmm. didn't put as much pressure maybe as some of their peers did. They were fine with people, you know, if they wanted to work from home, if that's where they felt safe, that was fine by them. Obviously, some other banks, they were a little bit more strongly pushing people to come back, especially their senior traders. So I definitely think you see a difference in tone, which definitely indicates, you know, they operate separately, obviously, and have yeah. different thoughts on this. But there are those forums, I think, where if one has discovered, you know, one way to operate a trading floor more safely, then they'll share that information in due course.
All right, going to leave it there. Hey, Jenny, thank you so much. Jenny Serain, finance reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone in New York City.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close, and back with us is John Traynor. He's Chief Investment Officer at People's United Advisors, roughly $9 billion in assets under management. John with us, joining Tim and myself. He is on the phone in Bridgeport, Connecticut. This, as we see, as Charlie mentioned, stocks pretty much hovering near their best levels of the session. So, Tim, we're up about 1% here.
There's optimism.
There is some optimism. Hey, John, come on in on this. The optimism that we're seeing in the markets, it seems to be over stimulus, potentially another round of aid coming from the federal government. How do you see it right now?
Well, it would be fantastic to get this behind us. We're frankly surprised it's taken this long, but boy, any stimulus that we can get would really give us a nice head of steam heading into next year. So I think that's what you're seeing in the market. It's almost a relief rally, but it's long overdue and great to hear. Great to see.
What size stimulus do we need?
You know, our GDP forecast for next year is 3.7%.
It's lower than others. That's lower than a lot of the big banks.
Yeah, it is. It is. A lot of them have been moving up, and it really is based upon the stimulus. If we get, I've seen the cuts where everybody says at $1 trillion, here's my forecast. At $1.5 trillion, my forecast moves up. So what we'd love to see is the stimulus come out. Let's see how it's impacted. We hope it's really focused on helping the unemployed and helping small business, and we could potentially be moving up our GDP forecast based upon what we see. So, you know, it's only positive news for us going into next year from the GDP side.
Yeah, so positivity. So I do wonder, in terms of portfolio allocation or where you want to kind of allocate some new money, I'm looking at some of the names that you're interested. A lot of them are consumer-based, Nike, Dollar General. What's the Nike story for you?
You know, for us, one of the things we're looking at are companies that are really controlling their destiny through increased sales. And Nike has just done a fantastic job, not only through the normal retail channels, but on the direct-to-consumer side. Mm. So we like Nike just because we see accelerating revenue growth next year, you know, driven by organic growth, and that to us is really going to be rewarded next year. So we like that story.
What about Dollar General? That's a company that you have on your list too.
Yeah, Dollar General. I mean, they've been a great retailer. They've benefited from the pain that we've seen this year, and we think, you know, we still have 10 million people unemployed. If you drew a line at $60,000 in income, people above that are actually doing fairly well. If you're in that lower sector, employment is still down 20% from where we were at the beginning of the year. So we see Dollar General and their target market is continuing to do well next year, almost as a buffer against really some of the pain that we've seen. So we like them going forward, but we want to be exposed to companies. Really, if you're in the retail sector, we want to see that sales momentum continuing. That to us is the key.
Yeah, I mean, Dollar General has been on such a tear. I'm just looking at kind of annual returns. And we saw it after the financial crisis, right? Like, you know, all of a sudden people who couldn't afford to maybe go to some other retailers or for even some of the basics, they ended up going to Dollar General and they really picked up some new customers.
Exactly. And, you know, even though, you know, we will see some stimulus, we believe with the vaccine, we're going to see a rebound in retail. We will see a, you know, we'll start to go back out to restaurants. That pain in the employment market is going to continue with us for a while. We have a lot of people to get back to work. So Dollar General will still be a bargain for a lot of people.
Up 44% last year, and it's up trending higher again this year.
Wow. It's
up 33% this year.
It's been on a tear.
Yeah.
Like you said. Yeah. What about when it comes to Cummins? Because this is kind of a bet on the global economy, right?
It is global and then infrastructure. And what we've been doing, you know, you asked about portfolio positioning. What we've been doing this year, and we really started to do it in July, we entered the year with a real growth bias on in our portfolio, and that has treated us very well this year. Mm-hmm. But in July, we got more, you know, more confidence in the Fed, more confidence in the stimulus. We thought we would have a vaccine, so we said at some point that value trade, that broadening trade, is going to work out well. So starting in July, we started to increase our exposure to the more cyclical sectors of the market, and Cummins on a global basis is one of those companies that we want to own. You know, we think that they're positioned well for not only the U.S., but really a global rebound. But you really want to be exposed to more cyclical sectors, not dramatically, not the deep cyclicals, but you want to be exposed to more economically sensitive stocks as you head into next year.
What specifically about Cummins? You could play that economically sensitive, you know, cycle a couple of different ways when it comes in, you know, kind of the industrial space. Why Cummins, though, specifically?
Well, just because we like the fact that they're market leaders, they're very well exposed to not only trucking but the construction business, and we just think you're going to see, you know, if you see investments in infrastructure, Cummins is going to be a big player in that, and we think on a global basis, infrastructure is going to be one of the key areas that we'll benefit from.
It's already up 24% this year.
Yeah,
it's had a good run, a very good run, but we see a lot more in it.
Thermo Fisher Scientific, ticker is TMO, stock's up almost 45%. You've got a forward-looking PE of about 25. Mm-hmm. What is it? And you've also got a little bit of a dividend there. But what is it about this one? Is it just that whole health tech explosion that we're seeing coming off of COVID?
Yeah, we've liked Thermo for quite a while, and we almost look at it as our chicken way of playing the healthcare, playing the biotech cycle, because, you know, for us, it's very difficult, and for a lot of analysts, it's very difficult to find the company that's going to have the hot new drug that'll get approval. What we'd rather do is buy the arms supplier to that marketplace. No matter who you are, if you're doing research, you need to work with Thermo. So it's our way to benefit from the biotech revolution going on in the country right now, but to do it on a broad-based basis rather than try and pick the right company with the right drug.
And they're $186 billion market cap. Are they the market leader? I'm curious how fragmented this market is.
Now, Thermo is the market leader. They are the play in this space, and it's what we would consider to be just it's our bread and butter holding in this area.
I can see why. Interesting stuff. Hey, love talking names with you, John. Thank you so much. Be well, stay safe, and have a good holiday. John Traynor, Chief Investment Officer at People's United Wealth Management, $9 billion in assets under management, based in Bridgeport, Connecticut. I love talking names.
Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or at Bloomberg.com. And be sure to check out our daily radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio. And be sure to watch us, too, on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.